On This Week in Enterprise Tech, U.S. passports are meaningless, your SSD is puny, Ajit Pai is not a very good lawyer, and the Divi Project hopes to clear the FUD from around the blockchain. Twiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twiet.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 279, recorded February 23rd, 2018. The Divi Project. Will cryptocurrency finally go mainstream? This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully so that you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Get started at rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Welcome to Twiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professionals, the IT pros, and the geeks who just want to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I can't guide you by myself. That's an awfully big task. I'm going to need the help of some experts and some friends, starting with Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, how are you, my friend?
Padre, I'm a little tired, been working hard, and getting a lot of things ready. It's lots of changes here in the swamp. As a matter of fact, this will be the last time I'm on Twiet from this particular studio. After more than 20 years, we're finally leaving Gainesville, getting ready for our next adventure. So the next time on Twiet, it will be with both a new, at least temporary studio, and a new lower third. News in that direction coming up, and I'll share that at the end of the show.
Oh, Curtis, you always tease so well. And of course, we all know that moving is the least stressful activity you can ever do in your life. So, my friend, I wish you well. Also, let's go to the other side. Let's go to the left side of the country to Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. The Geek in Paradise, Chibert, how are things over in the volcano area?
Things are great. I spent the weekend bobbing around in Kaneohe Bay working on fiber optics for a new wave power buoy experiment. And also been spending some time finishing up the automation on a brand new video wall for the Sea Grant program. Lots of fun, lots of toys.
Wait, these are the buoys that allow you to detect sea levels, like tsunami changes, right?
No. No Rihanna this time. Oh, sorry. No. This one actually has a little big giant barrel that bobs up and down and drives an air compressor that drives turbines and makes power.
Chibert, I was really hoping that your work might help us defend off an alien invasion one day. But alas, I'll have to do with barrels. Well, gentlemen, we've got a absolutely packed show today. Not only are we going to be going over some of the news bits and some of the more newsworthy bits of information coming out of the world of IT, but we've got a special guest, a lead full-stack developer with the Divi Project. If you wanted to know about cryptocurrency, about the blockchain and its use in the enterprise, you're going to want to stay tabbed. But first, as we always do, let's kick it off with the blips. Now, 11 years ago, U.S. passports saw the largest security redesign in an era with the introduction of the e-passport. Issued since 2006 and the only option for a new passport since 2007, the e-passport included anti-forgery and anti-tamper features in the form of an RFID-readable smart chip that could store 64 kilobytes of personal and biometric data. Aside from the security concerns over the contactless chip, which has some people, myself included, storing their passports in a Mylar sleeve and not in use, since the chip can be read from a distance once the passport's shielded cover is opened, the e-passport has been accepted as a functional identification tool that dramatically reduces the chances of fraud and ID theft with the on-chip information secured by a cryptographic signature. Except, it doesn't. Because the U.S. Customs and Border Protection don't have the technical knowledge to verify that cryptographic signature. a letter from U.S. Senators Wyden and McCaskill to the acting commissioner of the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency spells out one of the most puzzling security failures of the digital era, namely that after spending hundreds of millions of dollars to overhaul the U.S. passport, equip e-passport readers at points of entry, and retrain its staff to properly verify travelers with e-passports, why did the USCBP then not give its people the software necessary to verify the cryptographic signature? Worse still, the USCBP has been aware of the problem at least since 2010 and has taken no steps to correct the deficiency. The fact that they don't verify the cryptographic signature means that there is no real authentication of the data contained on the 64 kilobyte smart chip. In other words, the last decade of international travel has been the worst type of security feature.
Well, our friend Bill Gates is warning big tech companies that they are heading down the road to regulation. Bill Gates warns that big tech companies aren't worried enough about government regulation. In a new interview with Axios a couple days ago, they specifically called out Apple and other tech giants. Gates argues that companies are inviting government intervention by flaunting hubris, saying they need to be very careful that they are not trying to think their view is more important than the government's view or than the government being able to function in some key areas. I'm offering this as a cautionary tale, reminding folks that historically upset consumers and Congress tend to invite government intervention. Just ask Ma Bell about their experience during the breakup.
There's a new Mirai variant that turns IoT devices into proxy servers. The latest iteration of Mirai is dubbed OMG, and it turns infected IoT devices into proxy servers while also retaining the original malware's DDoS attack capabilities. Security researchers at Fortinet recently encountered the new Mirai variant and say the modification likely provides the malware authors another way to generate money from the code. Now, this follows Satori, another IoT bot malware based on Mirai code, which was discovered in December and is designed for mining cryptocurrencies rather than launching DDoS attacks. OMG uses an open source tool called 3Proxy as its proxy server. For the proxy to work properly, OMG includes two strings containing a command for adding and removing certain firewall rules so as to allow traffic on two random ports. OMG also packs most of the functionality of the original Mirai malware, including the ability to look for open ports and kill any process related to Telnet, HTTP, and SSH, and to use Telnet brute force logins to spread. According to Fortinet, OMG is the first Mirai variant that incorporates both the original DDoS functionality as well as the ability to set up proxy servers on IoT devices.
Storage bragging rights have become a little passé as of late. Yes, SSDs have gotten bigger. Yes, controllers have gotten faster. And the successful transition to 3D NAND flash means that prices are once again coming down. In fact, even my monster 2 terabyte Kingston flash drive just doesn't seem as impressive anymore. Well, that's all going to change with Samsung's brand new, PM1643, a very nondescript name for a solid-state drive with a staggering 30.72 terabytes of capacity. They accomplished this feat by combining 32 1-terabyte NAND packages and stacking them into a double-height 2.5-inch SSD. Now, speed is great, but not incredible. It should hit reads of 2100 megabytes per second and writes of 1700 megabytes per second, which falls short of the PCIe-connected enterprise storage speed champions like the DCP-1000, which hits 6800 and 6000 respectively. But it does pack all this capacity into a hot-swappable SAS package, which is definitely preferred in applications that could actually take advantage of this amount of storage. It should be noted that Seagate showed off a 60-terabyte SSD in a 3.5-inch package, but that SSD seemed to be more of a proof of concept, while the Samsung PM1643 is actually being manufactured. No word on pricing yet, but it's going to be crazy expensive, as in sell your car expensive. Still, we can dream.
Germany wants to do something about getting people out of their cars and into public transportation. Germany has been described as a car nation and has surprised neighbors with a radical proposal to reduce road traffic by making public transport free. as Berlin scrambles to meet the European Union air pollution targets and avoid huge fines. Quote, "We are considering public transport free of charge in order to reduce the number of private cars." Three ministers, including the Environment Minister Barbara Hendricks, wrote to EU Environmental Commissioner Carmenu Vella in a letter seen by AFP Tuesday. So this is a thinly veiled pleas to the politicians and pleas to the politicians in Honolulu and other metropolitan areas around the United States. Public transportation doesn't necessarily have to make a lot of money. Losing money slowly but taking thousands of cars off the road is a huge win for this and future generations.
The SEC says that companies must disclose more info on data risks and do it sooner. The Securities and Exchange Commission has issued updated guidance for public companies that calls for providing investors more information on their cybersecurity incidents as well as their cybersecurity risks in a more timely fashion. In what's called an interpretive guidance statement released yesterday, the commission also said corporate officers, directors, and other corporate insiders can't trade shares if they have unpublicized knowledge of a security incident at the company. The SEC used the phrase timely fashion in the directive, but it didn't specify exactly what that phrase means. It did, however, reiterate the need to disclose breaches and security risks sooner and with more information. Just like with Sarbanes-Oxley, the SEC is telling the board to figure out how they will govern and oversee all risks, but most especially cybersecurity risks and incidents.
Now, the end-user licensing agreement has been a thing of contention for the past decade or so, with some truly despicable tactics used in shrink-wrap licensing to beat back the time-tested doctrine of first sale. Most of the big players, from Apple to Microsoft to Oracle and John Deere, have tried using the EULA to kinda, sorta, just a little claim that you don't actually own the thing that you just bought. Sadly, for the most part, those players have triumphed in court, leading us to wonder exactly what it is that we're giving them our cash for. But now there's a victory the other way, and it involved Disney? A California federal court has sided with Redbox against Disney in the latter suit over digital download codes. Here's the gist. Redbox buys retail copies of the movies it puts into its machines. Along with the DVD or Blu-ray copy in each box, Disney also includes a piece of paper with a digital download code, entitling the owner to download a copy of the same movie. Redbox has no use for the digital download code, so they were reselling them. Disney took umbrage because Redbox had not made a distribution agreement with them. Then they filed suit, claiming that the EULA prevented the resale of the download code apart from the physical media. Judge Pregerson, in a 26-page order, sided with Redbox, saying that the shrink-wrap license did not actually create a, quote, enforceable contract, unquote, and that the doctrine of first sale meant that Redbox was entitled to do what it wanted to with a combo pack, up to and including the sale of the code. With the judge disassembling Disney's EULA enforcement, the only thing left is copyright, which, according to a similar 2015 case involving Adobe, is, quote, exhausted once the owner places a copy of a copyrighted item into the stream of commerce by selling it, unquote. The TLDR is this: if you don't want us to sell it, then don't sell it to us. That does it for the blips. Next up, we're going to get to the bites. And yeah, folks, it's going to be about net neutrality again. We got to go back to that well. But before we do that, let's go ahead and take a moment to thank the sponsor of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now, let me ask you something. The last time you went in for a mortgage, did you enjoy it? Was it fun? Did you want to do it again? Did you leave that mortgage experience thinking, I want to do that again next week? Well, probably not, because mortgage experiences are normally horrible. They just haven't kept up to date. They involve you going into a bank and trying to prove your worth to some guy who really doesn't care. Well, folks, if you're tired of that, if you want a mortgage experience that lives in the digital age, if you want a mortgage experience that actually custom tailors your mortgage for you, who you are and what you do, then, well, you're going to be happy as I am to have Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans as a sponsor of the Twiat Riot. Now, the mortgage experience just wasn't keeping up with the times. It was dated and it needed a client-focused technological revolution. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Now, it's simple. It allows you to fully understand all the details and be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Not just the right mortgage, but one that actually fits your style of life. It's convenient. Their trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. It's powerful. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, Rocket Mortgage is able to perform thousands of calculations in just seconds. And with those calculations, based on your income, your assets, and your credit, Rocket Mortgage can analyze all of the home loan options for which you qualify and then find the one that's just right for you. It's Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. That's rocketmortgage.com/enterprise. Equal housing lender license in all 50 states and MLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030. And we thank Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans for their support of this week in enterprise tech. Let's get back to it. We've got to talk about net neutrality, specifically about the states preserving net neutrality if the Fed won't. Now, let's rewind a year. Remember, just as FCC Chairman Ajit Pai started hinting that he was going to oversee the undoing of net neutrality, well, the states like California, New York, and Colorado announced that they were going to create net neutrality legislation at the state level that might actually be more restrictive than the federal net neutrality regulations. Well, the ISPs panicked, and they all contacted Ajit Pai. So Ajit Pai appended something to his language. He added that the repeal made it clear that broadband was an interstate commerce, and therefore any federal regulation, or lack thereof, that's important, would take precedence over state legislation. Now, Pai, the FCC, and the ISPs thought that that was that. The net neutrality regulations were repealed late last year, and yesterday the FCC published the regulations that will rescind it, which means we're heading towards the end game that will finally take away the FCC's net neutrality authority. Or not. 27 states have pending net neutrality legislation, and 5 states, Vermont, Montana, New Jersey, Hawaii, and New York, have governors who have issued executive orders to protect net neutrality. And several are still actively suing the FCC, which will further push back the actual removal of federal net neutrality regulations. But then again, some just see it as a delaying tactic. Eventually, those lawsuits will end, and eventually, the federal regulations will trump state regulations, ending net neutrality for good. But not so fast. There are a couple of issues. The first one is, does the FCC actually have the right to block state efforts? Chibert, I want to throw this over to you because you've done a little bit of research on this. It's interesting because it's not clear that the FCC actually has the authority to say our regulations or lack of regulations supersede your authority.
You know, I'm far from an expert. I'm going to read a statement from Harold Feld, a longtime telecom lawyer and a senior VP of consumer advocacy for Group Public, Public Knowledge. Quote, if Congress explicitly withheld authority over broadband from the FCC, it withheld from the FCC the power to preempt any contrary state authority. Yep. Keep that in mind, contrary state authority. The relevant case on this is National Association of Regulatory Commissioners versus FCC, also called NARUC 2. There, the FCC attempted to preempt state regulation of cable leased access channels under its general Title I authority. And at that time, Congress had not passed the Cable Act. The D.C. Circuit found that the FCC's general power over interstate communication did not give it the authority to preempt state regulation. Now, if we translate that, does that really mean the FCC doesn't have any teeth? That's my spin on it. You know, I think Ajit Pai and the FCC are trying to play both sides of the track at once. And these guys, you know, Harold Feld and a few other folks are calling the FCC on the carpet saying, hey, you can't have it both ways. You've not said anything about it. Title I doesn't give you the rights. So you can't override what the states are doing.
Yeah, there's a couple of different issues here. The first one is that just overall, is there actually this authority? The FCC is trying to extend a principle that the federal government uses for interstate commerce, specifically the highway and transportation system. It makes sense. When you think about it, if you've got commerce going between the states, there has to be a legislative body that is above the states. Otherwise, you could have the states gaming the system, trying to gain an advantage over their neighbors. That's not the case here, though. It's not the same when you're talking about interstate commerce or interstate broadband regulations as when you're talking about interstate travel of goods and services. Now, that is a little bit iffy. It's a bit tricky. There is some precedent, but there's also precedent going the other way. There's another interesting hiccup to this, though, and that is, if you remember, along with the net neutrality regulations or the removal of the net neutrality regulations, Ajit Pai was looking down the line and he realized, wait a minute, I'm reversing the previous FCC commissioner's orders here. So what can I do to make sure that the next FCC commissioner doesn't just undo my orders? So it's not just a removal of the net neutrality regulations. It's not just a reclassification of ISPs under a different title, according to the Telecommunications Act. He also removed the FCC authority over broadband entirely. In fact, he specifically said that it was a fallacy that Congress had granted the FCC the power to do this. That's his whole point. He said Wheeler overreached. Wheeler never should have been able to regulate the ISPs in the first place. Well, if that's true, and if he's now saying that the FTC has full authority over all broadband companies because it's just trade, then he basically said, you need to pay no attention to the regulations I'm putting into place because I don't have authority. Yeah, that makes no sense. I want to go over to you, Curtis, because this is one of these things that has been sort of mulled over at bars here in the Silicon Valley where people are wondering, wait a minute, did Ajit Pai really just say we have no authority over the thing that I'm claiming authority over? I mean, what's your take?
Well, I think this is one of those cases where someone can dive into the giant festering pool of unintended consequences when they try to not just do something, but try to do it in a way that can't be undone. And again, let me preface this. I am not a lawyer, a constitutional lawyer, or any other sort of lawyer. But what I do foresee coming from all of this is some massive lobbying efforts. Because to be brutally honest, the ISPs, especially the big multi-state ISPs, would have loved for him to find some way to finesse this. So he said, the FCC does have authority. I'm saying that there will be no regulation under the authority and there's no changing it. He couldn't do that. So his big failsafe was to say, you know what? We have no authority anyway. It's done. Well, with that said, you're right. He's saying, hey, we never had the right to make any regulations in the first place. So everything is null and void, which leaves the door open to the states. Where I think the lobbying is going to come in is with Congress for them to grant explicitly some agency the right to regulate this, or to say that there will be, again, explicitly, no regulation on the federal level, and that this lack of regulation preempts any regulation on the state level. This is all going to take a lot of time to work through. So what's really happening is that we have a 50-state Wild West, my guess is for at least the next 18 to 24 months.
Yeah, and that's actually my take on this too, because you're right. The proper thing to do would be for Congress to sit down and say, okay, we need to make an agreement that all the states can agree on. We need to make an agreement that is more or less neutral across all 50. We need to make an agreement that will allow the states to have certain powers over the things that they should have powers over. However, with the state of Congress right now, there's no way in the world that's going to happen. And so what Ajit Pai has essentially done is he's fed the power vacuum. By saying that the FCC has no right to regulate ISPs and broadband providers, he's essentially saying they're outside the law, which that no, that's not going to work. We'll come back to that in a little bit. But there is another argument here. There is another facet that we do need to take a look at. And that is the fact that even if you were to agree with Ajit Pai, and even if you were to say, you know what, he's right, the FCC never should have gotten into this net neutrality business. They never should have gotten into the business of regulating the ISPs and the broadband providers. They never should have, in the first place, asserted any authority over broadband providers. And there should be no legislation against them doing what they want. There is still the fact that states can still choose who they do business with. This is not a power that's held by the federal government. This is not something that is kept from the states. This is not even something that Ajit Pai has suggested that they can't do, which means even if you were completely on the side of Ajit Pai and the current FCC, you have to agree that California, Nevada, or any of the 27 states that currently are trying to create their own net neutrality regulations could actually use their commerce powers, separate from their legislative powers, to enforce a net neutrality-like policy. Now, Chiebert, this would be messy because they couldn't specifically call it net neutrality. They would have to base all their decisions off of who they thought were offering the best services for their citizens. What would that even look like?
It would, oh geez. I'm not even sure I want to speculate on that because you're right. It would be messy. It's a Band-Aid, you know, apologies to Johnson & Johnson. the reality is it's going to be kind of like how, I don't know, what's a good analogy? Maybe it's like how certain states you can drink when you're 18, but the Federal Highways Commission said, no, if you want federal highway money, you're going to have to change that to 21. Same thing with 55 mile an hour speed limits. There some states have said, well, okay, we don't care. That's the kind of mess that we're looking at. We could have states saying we're going to do one thing, and then we're going to have little Band-Aids from the federal government, you know, different agencies say, no, we want you to do this anyway. And if you don't, we're going to withhold federal funding from you. Purchasing power is going to be a really, really interesting way of doing things. I personally think it's the wrong way to do it. I think Congress really and truly does need to do something. This power vacuum that's being created is just giving everybody massive, massive headaches. Yeah. And it's, you know, I'm sorry, Congress, get off your butt and do something. You can't just sit back and watch and let that wild dog just go and mess up the internet that we've spent so much time and energy and creativity building.
Yeah. You know, Curtis, it strikes me that Pai, and he has been consistent about this. He truly believes in the philosophy that the more you deregulate, the more that you'll encourage investment, and specifically investment by broadband providers. And I get that. I can respect that that's been his overarching philosophy for years and years and years. However, it seems to me that we are headed. It's not actually not even we're headed. We are at the point where instead of one policy that he disagrees with, he's going to deal with 40 to 50 policies that are all different and all telcos, all broadband providers are going to have to navigate. There's no way that that encourages investment. I mean, if Comcast has to make 50 different agreements with 50 different states, all based on their arbitrary rules of what is best for our consumers, that's business killing, right?
Oh, absolutely. And that's why you're going to see what is going to be some pretty intensive lobbying about this. Because, you know, in the same way that the internet retail companies fought for so very long against collecting sales tax, because face it, there even going beyond the state by state sales tax, there is locality by locality sales tax. They didn't want to have to deal with hundreds of different sales tax rates. Well, no ISP wants to have to deal with even as few as 50 different regulations on what open internet means. They want certainty. And frankly, I think that if you ask them and they answered honestly, most of the CEOs of these companies would say they honestly preferred what existed 10 months ago over what's happening now, because they might not have liked it, but it was certain. It was uniform across the U.S., and they could work with it. They could figure out how to game that. Now figuring out how to use all of these 50 state regulations to their best advantage is going to be brutally difficult. And that's why, ultimately, you're right, Congress must act. I just think, to be brutally honest, the window has closed on Congress acting on this year. And it's going to take a while to figure out what Congress comes into existence after November. And I think it's worth mentioning that whether you agree with this organization or not, an organization injected even more politics into this today when the NRA gave Ajit Pai their Charlton Heston Award for courage because of what he's done to, as they put it, save the free internet. All of a sudden, you have more politics here, more emotion here, and none of that is useful when you're trying to come up with thoughtful, consistent, rational regulation across the entire nation.
Well, Curtis Chiebert, again, we're going to come back at some point, maybe in a month, maybe in 2 weeks, who knows. We will be back on this topic because it is important. I mean, when you consider what the show is about enterprise communications, the backbone's kind of a big thing. So we shall return. But for now, we get to go to my favorite part of every episode, and that is when we bring in a guest from outside to share some knowledge with the Twiat Ride. And this time, I am pleased to have Nick Saponaro. Yes, I hope I said that correct. He is the Divi Projects co-founder and VP of technology. He is now their lead full-stack developer. Nick, thank you very much for coming on to This Week in Enterprise Tech. And did I say your last name correctly?
You sure did. Actually, it's better than most, so okay. Thank you.
Fantastic. Okay, now, of course, we're going to have to start at the very basic, because anytime we start talking about cryptocurrency, anytime we start talking about blockchain, there's going to be a lot of preconceived notions that get brought into the conversation. Let's start with, what is the Divi project? You're the project co-founder. What was it that you were trying to do?
So what we're trying to do with the Divi project, you know, it's me and four other co-founders that started this project. What we did was we took a look at cryptocurrency from our experience with both trading and researching it, and we tried to find the most prevalent issue, which in our opinion is ease of use. I think a lot of people are scared or apprehensive, I should probably say, about getting involved with cryptocurrency because it's a relatively daunting task, and that is the problem that we're trying to solve.
Right. We should at first mention that there is a difference between cryptocurrency and the blockchain. A lot of people conflate the two. Blockchain is just a technology that allows for a distributed ledger, which is a very interesting project in and of itself. And cryptocurrency, of course, everyone's first going to think to Bitcoin. But there are, I think literally now, there are hundreds of different types of cryptocurrency, some of which use blockchain technology, some of which don't. Where does the Divi project fall in this big stew of blockchain cryptocurrency?
Yeah, no, that's great that you made that distinction. I make that distinction with people all the time, and you're right. Actually, there are thousands of cryptocurrencies now, and we are a cryptocurrency that uses blockchain technology to secure and verify the transactions and, of course, keep the open and accessible ledger.
Let's dive into this, because I have a actually relatively dated understanding of the blockchain. It's from, 6 or 7 years ago when I dabbled with Bitcoin and then a Dogecoin, all the fun things. It was just something to do with my computer. And I studied the underlying technology a little bit. And when we're talking about a distributed ledger, most of the time we're talking about the Bitcoin way of doing a distributed ledger, which is you reward clients or nodes for doing a work. You do a proof of work for each node. The winning one, the one that turns it in first, becomes the block that gets added to the chain. That chain gets distributed to all the nodes. Now, what's the limit of that? I mean, is that how blockchain works all across the board, or does it differ from cryptocurrency to cryptocurrency, application to application?
Well, there are a lot of new protocols being developed. Ours is differentiated from Bitcoin's proof of work protocol. We're a proof of stake protocol. The concept is generally the same, where you have a network of, as you say, nodes basically trying to solve a puzzle before the other nodes do. And as a reward for solving that puzzle, your block is added to the blockchain, and all of the transactions that were made in that the time it takes to solve that equation go through your node. And of course, you're rewarded for that in our case, Divi. But there are a multitude of new protocols that are coming out. And of course, each one offers a different benefit and, of course, its own set of challenges as well.
Okay, interesting, because you mentioned that yours is more of a proof of stake rather than a proof of work. I'm very familiar with the proof of work concept, which is basically solving an equation, coming up with a hash that matches the solution, and therefore you win, you're rewarded. What's proof of stake?
So proof of stake is, like I said, it's very similar in terms of, you know, your node is attempting to solve this cryptographic equation. The difference is that it requires far less computer resources. So where to be a successful Bitcoin miner at this point, you pretty much have to set up a huge operation, because you're competing with miners that have warehouses full of these of this mining equipment. Proof of work is also heavily intensive on energy. So it's bad for the environment and it's bad for your electric bill too. Proof of stake allows you to essentially stake your tokens or hold them in a program that does the same thing. It secures and verifies transactions on the network, but it requires far less energy and far less computer resources. So you don't need to make this huge investment in mining equipment. You can actually run it on a virtual private server like DigitalOcean or AWS.
Okay. I'm sorry. I'm going to deep dive a little bit more on this because that has me fascinated. We've actually covered this on This Week in Enterprise Tech, the idea that the proof of work as it operates in currently in Bitcoin is so energy intensive because you will have literally tens of millions of nodes crunching the exact same equation looking for that proof of work. Only one of them will actually win. Only one of them will be rewarded. And yet you've expended that energy for all of the nodes. So how does proof of stake not do the exact same thing?
So because proof of stake is the proof is in your stake. So in our case, we've devised a 5-tiered system where there are varied levels of staking or varied levels of entry. So in our case, again, the more you stake, the more you earn, and actually the faster your node can determine that cryptographic hash. It's just a different protocol inherently in that it doesn't work off of the computer's resources. A lot of the miners now have like the Ant miners, or there are still people mining off of their graphics cards and things like that. It just doesn't require that. It uses your stake as the proof of verification.
Oh. Okay, that actually, wow. Okay, that is very, very different, because you're right. The old way of doing something like the Bitcoin proof of work was to stack up as many graphic cards as you could. Now you actually do need custom ASICs if you're going to make back your investment, because there's no way you could do it with just GPUs. You're saying you're not requiring them to prove a work. You're requiring them to prove that they actually hold tokens.
That's correct.
Okay. All right. I can go with that. All right. Now let's dive into some of the claims that you're making. The Divi Project is claiming. You are claiming that this is an enterprise-grade cryptocurrency system. What does that mean in your mind? You're pitching this as a B2B, an M2M type solution. Why does B2B and M2M need a cryptocurrency solution? And why is Divi that cryptocurrency solution?
That's a great question. So I think it actually starts from a consumer level. So we're creating a cryptocurrency that's a lot easier to use for the average consumer. And it's a lot safer. And when I say safer, I mean, of course, the security is there, the cryptographic security, but a lot of people will have issues sending money to the wrong address, for example. So we offer a system that allows for username and password usage. So it limits a lot of those user errors. Now, all this to say that the more user adoption that you garner, the more attractive it becomes to enterprises. And by architecting our software to be more scalable and allow for dynamic changes, we produce a system that is better for, as you say, enterprises or businesses to use, both for the send and spend of crypto, but also for transactional things like onboarding of new customers.
Yeah. So this is okay for those in the audience who maybe aren't really big on cryptocurrency right now. The way that you would do it with Bitcoin, and I'm going to use Bitcoin because basically right now it really is Bitcoin and Ethereum. Everything else is a derivative of that or is based on the exchange of those two. Is you have an address. It's a long set of characters, and if you get one wrong, you send it to the wrong address. That's your transaction system. So what Divi is trying to do is you're trying to bring it back to something that, well, maybe the people in the M2M and the B2B market actually understand. Everyone's probably used something like a PayPal. You're closer to PayPal, but you're using a cryptocurrency.
That's 100% correct. We believe in a design-first focus. On our technology, we look at technology from the user's standpoint, just as most tech companies do. You know, if the user experience is familiar and intuitive, we find that people are more likely to adopt it.
Yeah, we do have a question from the chat room. And actually, I'm sorry, I should have asked this before. What are you looking at for transactional speed as your network gets burdened? Because this is a big problem with Bitcoin right now. The network just can't handle the number of transactions that are coming in. And that's why transaction fees are going way up. And that's why transaction wait times have gone way up. How do you get around that with Divi?
So, yeah, obviously, there's a lot of scaling issues within multiple cryptocurrencies, most notably, obviously, being Bitcoin and Ethereum. So what we've done is our blockchain team, who are absolute geniuses, are essentially re-architecting our software to allow to pull in scalability technologies from other tokens, including Bitcoin. As we see, the Lightning Network has already improved the transaction price, and it seems that speed is increasing as well. Ethereum as well is working on the Casper network, and there are multiple other projects in the Ethereum ecosystem like Raiden that aim to increase that scalability and speed. So we are lucky in that we didn't come first. We can learn from some of the mistakes or missteps or inherent, I won't say flaws, but just challenges that that some cryptocurrencies have already faced. So we're in a good position in that sense.
I do have a question here from Emily the Strange, who kind of wants to know about the backing. And again, this is one of the basic questions that you need to answer in any sort of cryptocurrency primer. Bitcoin is pegged against the dollar. You have Ethereum, which is also pegged against the dollar. But then you also have other cryptocurrencies which are pegged against Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies. And you basically nest them inside of each other. Where does Divi get its inherent value from? What are you pegged against?
So, yeah, at the moment, we are pegged against Bitcoin, like most altcoins are.
Right.
In the future, we'd like to offer our own on-ramp from fiat to Divi, but that will be there are regulatory hurdles that need to be jumped before we can actually implement that type of technology. But of course, yeah, in the future. And I think all cryptos have the unfortunate reality of being pegged against Bitcoin at the moment. And I see a lot of talk in the community about changing that and finding ways to give coins inherent value based on other intrinsic factors.
Right. Well, I mean, it's very difficult to peg against something that is ridiculously volatile. I'm assuming that doesn't make it easy for you.
Well, no. I mean, as we've seen in the past just couple of months, Bitcoin has had a pretty rocky road. This is nothing new for people that are right, familiar with cryptocurrency. But obviously, a lot of newcomers came in during that last increase, and they just suffered their first correction. And so, yeah, it can be a challenge. Sure. Okay.
Well, before I'm going to bring my co-host back into the discussion in just a bit here. But before I get there, I do have one question, and that is about there's a negative connotation of cryptocurrencies. among those who aren't enthusiasts of cryptocurrencies. And right now there seems to be a huge divide. You're on the train and you're ready to make this a real thing and you're ready to actually invest in a cryptocurrency or an altcoin, or you think everything is a bubble and it's all going to explode. And of course, like most things, there's ground in the middle where we're going to meet. Why do you think that right now cryptocurrency has such a negative connotation with so many people, especially with, as you mentioned, the thousands of cryptocurrencies, some of which look just downright shady?
Well, yeah, you pretty much just said it right there. There are a couple of factors that contribute to the maybe negative connotations of cryptocurrency right now, one of which being the bad actors in the industry. There have been a lot of scam ICOs, and people have been unfortunate to lose money on those. That being said, there's a lot of incredible projects that are groundbreaking and very disruptive technologies. But it's also has a lot to do with media attention. The media seems to go back and forth on whether they like Bitcoin and cryptocurrency a lot. And I think that has a major influence over people's view of cryptocurrency. In the past, crypto has been sort of looked at as a money laundering scheme as well, which, I mean, people launder money with fiat currency too. We can pinpoint the negatives of cryptocurrency, but I think there are so many positives, not just with cryptocurrency, but with blockchain technology,
right.
That can benefit every industry worldwide. So.
Yeah. And that's actually one of the points that I really wanted to stretch out. And that's why I did make that differentiation at the start of the segment, which is, yeah, there's a cryptocurrency, but there's also the blockchain technology. And I especially love your proof of stake concept, because that's a different type of blockchain technology than what we've been accustomed to that addresses some of the biggest downsides, which is amazing. Before I bring in my co-host, I do want to say that one of the things I've said a lot whenever someone has asked me about cryptocurrency is that they have to realize it's a financial instrument. And just like any financial instrument, you need to know what it does, what it's based on, and what your risks are. In fact, that I think for me, that's one of the biggest negative connotation, sources of negative connotation for cryptocurrency, is that you have people investing in it because they see it going up and up and up and up, and they don't realize that, yeah, it is just a financial tool, which means at some point it's going to go down and then back up and then back down. And that's where people get hurt. But let me bring in my co-host, Chibert. Let's start with you, because I see you kind of bouncing around in my preview monitor. What is it that you wanted to bring to the discussion?
Actually, I want to pause my question and field a question from the chat room. Missing has a question. In the event that Divi gets hacked, how would you recover? Isn't it the case where one big exploit could put you under?
So that's a great question. Thank you for that one. So if you notice, a lot of the hacks that have occurred haven't actually happened on blockchains. They're happening to ancillary products, right? Things like wallets, things like exchanges that have their own set of security flaws. Blockchain is inherently secure. But that being said, we are taking many, many, sometimes very expensive steps to make sure that everything in our ecosystem, at least, is very secure. And because we are providing our own wallet and blockchain, we have a closed loop system, much like something like Apple, which is arguably the more secure mobile operating system within our ecosystem as well. So I hope that answers that question accurately.
All right, Chibert, and you also had a question about international funds.
Yeah. In a past life, I got involved with writing some software to do international funds transfer between a bank based in Hawaii and primarily Japan. And sadly, it was kind of primitive. So I'd like you to polish up your crystal ball and imagine a life where we could do international funds transfer and use maybe the Divi project. What do you say?
I would love for international funds transfer to go through Divi. I'd love to offer that level of enterprise technology with ours. And there are other cryptocurrencies that are attempting to achieve that goal and doing a pretty good job at it as well. Obviously, that's one of the main use cases or more obvious use cases for blockchain technology. You can make very fast or instant low fee transactions that are pretty much the most secure they could possibly be.
Okay. Curtis, I want to bring you in here because you've got the best view of what's actually happening in the C-suite in the enterprise. You know, getting past the cryptocurrency, and let's go focus more on the blockchain technology itself. Is there a lot of buzz, or have you heard a lot of buzz of potential applications for a distributed ledger using blockchain technology?
Oh, absolutely. I think there are a lot of people who are exploring different ways to use blockchain right now. As a matter of fact, I got an invitation to a big IBM, the IBM Think event that's going to be happening in Las Vegas in about a month. They have a couple of major tracks about IBM's blockchain technology and using it for things like supply chain, using it for agriculture, using it for a number of different things where what you need is a way to verify possession, verify chain of ownership, verify chain of value add. There are all kinds of situations where blockchain makes a ton of sense. To be brutally honest, I am very bullish on blockchain, even while I am very cautious about most of the cryptocurrencies available today.
IBM are working on their Hyperledger technology, and even SAP are working on their own ledger technology, blockchain technology. I think even JP Morgan, if I'm not mistaken, are working on their own as well. As you say, there are endless use cases for blockchain within enterprise and pretty much any business that has any sort of supply chain or business network relationships can use blockchain technology. And going back to what you said in the beginning, Reverend, you know, these are non-cryptocurrency use cases. It's doubtful that IBM would issue a cryptocurrency to accomplish the goals that their customers need.
Curtis, do you have a follow-up?
I actually do, and I want to dig in a little bit to something that you were talking about. As we noted, there has not really been a cryptocurrency hack. The blockchain is inherently secure, but you got to do something with your units of cryptocurrency. And you've talked about the wallet, the exchange. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, how much time and energy you've devoted to those aspects of your ecosystem to try and keep them secure, as opposed to the basic security of the cryptocurrency itself?
So, yeah, I mean, we have a philosophy here at Divi that is actually based on a quote from Abraham Lincoln, which is, if you give me 6 hours to chop down a tree, I will spend 4 sharpening the axe. I believe that's the quote. So we've spent months just scoping, planning, devising ways that there could be potential security flaws. And we really aim to hire the best and brightest people to secure our technologies. I also believe that, as I said before, having a relatively closed loop system provides the opportunity to be a lot more secure. That being said, we can't stop people from creating their own wallets and things of that nature, but they obviously wouldn't be supported by us.
Right. I want to dive a little bit deeper into some of the technological aspects of what you do, because you are a full stack developer and you've surrounded yourself with programmers. What is it that you find different between storing transactions in a blockchain versus, say, storing transactions in a traditional relational database? Because it can't be, the programming experience can't be the same. What are the biggest challenges?
Well, let's start with what's the difference, right? So with the traditional architecture, you have a centralized database that sends the data to the server, and the server sends the information to the client. In this case, usually it's a browser window. With blockchain, it's similar, but it's different in that the database is decentralized, right? So Amazon's not holding all of your transactional information. Google's not holding all of your personal information. In fact, only you are. You actually own the data and the information that you're utilizing and providing. So I think that's a huge, huge difference there. Yeah, definitely from a programming perspective, it changes things for sure. And as a full stack developer, I work more on the relationship between the blockchain and the client, whereas our blockchain developers work at more low level on the protocol and such. But we have to work hand in hand in order to provide a seamless experience between the two or three, between, you know, client, blockchain and such.
Connected to that, there is something that's different about Divi and your implementation of the blockchain versus, say, Bitcoin. Bitcoin is relatively flat. You've got all the nodes just basically doing what it is that they do. Divi is a tiered system, and you have super nodes. Why did you decide to go in that direction?
So, yeah, there's a couple reasons for that decision. And I think it's important to mention as well that our nodes, our masternode system is a one-click installation, right? So going back to our initial philosophy and problems that we're trying to solve of ease of use and accessibility, we wanted to make a masternode protocol that was not only easy to set up, just as easy as something like iTunes, but also accessible to the average person. So right now, another masternode protocol I mentioned is Dash. At the moment, a Dash masternode is close to $750,000, which is pretty inaccessible to the average person. So by offering a tiered system, we allow for varied levels of entry. So you can actually get in to right now a lower level masternode for a much more affordable price. That being said, you don't have to have a masternode to help us secure the network. You can, by the use of one of our algorithms, you're able to just stake tokens even without a masternode. Of course, the rewards payout is different there, but it would still work that way.
Okay, so let's get down to brass tacks here, because I'm starting to see these questions in the chat room. If someone was interested in getting themselves involved with Divi, if they wanted to take advantage of that masternode, which allows sort of the one-click install, the one-click mine, how would they do it? What kind of hardware is required? What are they looking at for startup? How would people get involved with what you've created?
Yeah, so when the masternodes are ready to be used by the general public, which we're looking right now at May, it's very simple. You don't really need, like I said in the beginning, you really don't need a crazy machine to do this. You can run it on a MacBook computer. Or just a regular laptop would work. If you don't want to leave your computer running all the time, you can deploy to the cloud. And we have devised a script that essentially deploys for you to the cloud. Of course, you can set up your own instances. And if you're more technologically inclined that way, you can definitely do it yourself. But that being said, we have, like I say, devised a, we call it a Mochi, which is the master one-click cloud install. And by the click of a button, you can deploy your masternode to, right now, it should work perfectly on a 512 megabyte, 4 gigabyte storage VPS.
Curtis Chiebert, I want to offer you any last words here, because we are unfortunately approaching the end of our time. Is there something that we need to ask, something that needs to be said about this? Because, I mean, we do talk about cryptocurrency. We do talk about blockchain probably more than is normal, but it is an interesting technology.
Well, I have just one quick question. It seems to me that especially when you're talking about business-to-business use, this is the kind of technology that could be remarkable in the developing world, where there is a lot of discussion about the unbanked, those people and institutions that really don't have access to any sort of developed world financial infrastructure. Is that one of the use cases that you're anticipating for Divi, or is this still mainly an industrialized Western world kind of technology?
No, 100%. We are looking at those underserved communities. There are I think 60% of the people on Earth have access to a smartphone, but less than half of the world actually has access to financial services, which I think in my mind is insane. So if we can provide a solution to those people to be able to transact easily and securely with cryptocurrency, then yeah, that's definitely one of our goals. It needs to happen, right? We need to, that's one of the primary purposes for cryptocurrency. It's the responsible redistribution of wealth among the masses, right?
There we go. I want to thank you so much for spending your time with us, Nick. We've been speaking with Nick Saponaro. Oh, gosh, I'm going to get that right at some point. He is the lead full-stack developer over at the Divi Project. He's also one of their co-founders. Nick, I want to give you this time. Could you please tell our audience where they can find you, where they can find the Divi Project, and any last words that you think they should know if they are looking at starting to maybe poke around cryptocurrency and the blockchain?
Sure. Well, first of all, any advice to newbies to the industry, do your research, read your white papers. Don't listen to YouTube shills or people telling you that you can make 100x on some coin. Don't look at blockchain and cryptocurrency like a get rich quick scheme. It's really a revolutionary technology that can change the way that we all live. Try to look at it that way and just do your research and become as educated as humanly possible. That being said, we'd love to have you guys on our Discord and Telegram channels, which you can find the links for on our website, diviproject.org. I'm in there pretty much 24 hours a day, and I'd love to talk to you guys. And if you have any questions, you can always tag me and reach out to me directly. I'm happy to answer any of those.
Nick, I am so happy that you said that. Thank you for telling our audience that, you know, really, again, the best way to do this is to get educated. And yeah, please stay away from the YouTube shills because we know who they are. Nick Saponaro. I got it right that time, yeah?
You got it.
I got it once. The lead full stack developer over at the Divi Project. We thank you for being part of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having me on.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You have used up another hour of your time listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 Antminers. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially my co-host, without whom I would not want to do the show. Cheever, let's start with you. What are you up to? What are you doing? Where can people find you? And what do you need people to know?
Well, I'm Cheever at twit.tv. My Twitter address is ADVNETLAB. But you know what? I want to say a little personal note. I get lots and lots of PR emails, and I saw one that really just struck my heartstrings. And I'm going to call it, we're all the same species. Everybody should be able to have a good time. This is the second annual Queer Gala, inviting 400-plus prominent LGBTQA and ally community members from all over New York City. They want to create an empowering and safe place for LGBTQTA individuals and their allies where students could actually take who they wanted as their date and wear whatever their hearts desired. Participants from last year expressed how they were someone who was not able to take the person I love to my own high school prom. The gala was an incredibly impactful event. It gave me a chance to express my love for my girlfriend in a positive environment. There wasn't a moment where I didn't feel welcome. So while I regret I personally will not be able to join the LGBTQA community at this party, I do want to express support for my fellow human beings.
Thank you, Cheever. Thank you. Actually, that's very important. I appreciate you bringing that up. Also, Curtis, who I guess we say goodbye to your studio, and we look forward to whatever it is that you might be announcing next week. Until then, where can we find you?
Well, as always, you can find me on Twitter at KG4GWA. And starting next week, you can find my byline at Dark Reading, where I will be joining them as an editor focusing on technology. So come on over to darkreading.com and look for me there. And yes, that means that I'll also be involved in things like Black Hat. Looking forward to that. It's a good group over there. I was actually one of the first columnists that they had at Dark Reading when they launched the site a long time ago. So it's nice to be working with folks that I enjoy and trust and respect. And so good things, and can't wait to have another full-time studio be a party when that happens.
You know, if you're going to be doing Dark Reading, I do have a Sith costume that you could use.
Perfect. Absolutely perfect.
Curtis Chiebert, thanks again. Over the years, it's been an absolute pleasure to work with you, and I'll see you again in future episodes of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Also, thanks to you, to the person who drops by every week to listen or watch our show to get your enterprise goodness. We wouldn't have a show for all these years if it weren't for you, and we want to make it a little easier for you to catch up on your IT news. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiet. That's T-W-I-E-T, This Week in Enterprise Tech. There you will find not just all of our back episodes, but also all of our notes. If you want to see the links to the stories that we've talked about, if you want to see what it is that we run the show on, you want to drop by. But more importantly, you can go to the little download links on the side where you can subscribe. This is important. If you really want to support the show, you can get an audio version, a video version, or a high-definition video version into your device of choice. It's the best way to make sure that you stay on top of IT and also to support the show. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me there, you get to see what I'm doing even when I'm not in the studio, like when I'm really, really tired. This little puppy just kind of pulls on my heartstrings. Please follow me, and who knows, maybe you might find out something new about what goes on here at the Twit TV studios. Finally, thanks to everyone here who makes this show possible, to Lisa and Leo, who have allowed us to continue doing Twiet for all these years, to our engineering staff, Alex and Burke and Jammer B, and yes, to our excellent, most excellent TD, the Shark Boy. Shark Boy, this is the time of the show where we ask you a question to see if you've actually been paying attention. Are you ready for this week's question?
Probably not.
Okay, here we go. In the two types of blockchain that we discussed today, there were two methodologies for getting your block approved for the chain. What were they?
Grinding and World of Warcraft.
Oh, so close, so close. No, I'm afraid the answer we were looking for was proof of work and proof of stake. But thank you for bringing in your vast gaming experience. Maybe you'll get it next week. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twiet.